Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, September 19th, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is Lola Dean. Today's session number is 2001-03 and it's titled Book Discussion of Stones from the River by Ursula Hagee. Let's listen in.
This was a tough part of the book, wasn't it? Yeah. Probably the hardest part. There's a couple parts in tomorrow's part that, remember too, that you've done the hardest reading. If we're up to page whatever we're supposed to be, we've got most of the book done. It's kind of like, you know, on Wednesday, you're kind of, now it's all coasting from here on. So the rest of the book does coast a little bit better, so hopefully it'll be a little better. But I think together, we can take comfort from each other. Because this must have been a really, really horrible time for people to get through. So, as we finished yesterday, John commented that there was a passage that we really should have gotten. Page
97.
That sort of tied together some of the things we were talking about yesterday. And let's see, John, why don't you locate us on that?
Okay, down two paragraphs up, well, three paragraphs up from the bottom, where it says your ability to adapt. And he's talking, this is Michael.
What, 197?
Right. And he's talking to his wife, who has given the passports to the Gestapo. And she says, well, they asked for them, what could I do? I have no other choice. And he's going, well, do you know where that leaves us? And then he goes down here to say, she says, we'll get them back in time. And he says, your ability to adapt is far more dangerous to you than any of them will ever be. You'll keep adapting and adapting until nothing is left. And I don't think he's just talking to her specifically. He's referring to the entire Jewish community. That how long can you keep adapting to these demands and this type of treatment before you have nothing left to give, and then of course you're extremely expendable. And this is kind of a like a prophetic view of the future. Mm-hmm. And this was 1933. Mm-hmm. He's looking forward. He can see what's coming. Mm-hmm. You get an inkling of it. And that leads you out into 1934.
That's a very good question too, isn't it? You know, how when do you say enough is enough? And even if Martin Luther didn't say here I stand. Dan is a good myth poker, isn't he? He just takes that away from us. But it makes you wonder, you know, and I think we don't think of this so much, but this happens in everyday life. You know, when do we finally say enough is enough? And that absolutely fantastic Ruth Young Nelson, I mean, when she stood up at her age, you know, for something she believed in. But I suspect this happens to us in lots of things that are a lot smaller than earth-shattering events. You know, when is enough? Is enough, and when do we stand and say that's it? Or do it be so much easier to adapt? None of us like to, I don't think. There's very few people who like to make waves. I'm sure we all know a few, and hope they don't serve on church councils with us. But most people just like things quiet. I'm always accused in my house, in my family, if things are going along too well, I'll do something to stir it up. And so I find several of my children are that way too, so we have kind of a lively family. But that is not the case with, I think, most things, especially in our world events. We don't like things being riled up. And I think that's why a lot of us are feeling just a little fatigue right now from last week. How do we respond? There's some interesting things in tomorrow's session that I think will have some bearing on our lives as they exist today. And this is, I think, the sign of a good book, is when you find things in it that make you wonder about what's happening to you in this time and this place. And that's what makes some books timeless, and others, you know, you read and you can't remember if you read them, like mysteries. And I don't know if any of you read mysteries, but they're like popcorn for me.
Takes you out of this world for a while.
That's right. And when things are really bad, you're going to find me reading mysteries. But I have to keep a list because I can't remember if I've read them. No, I don't always have a problem. I think I probably am numb when I read them. Okay, let's go on to 1934, page 201. I think is where we're supposed to start today. I have to check my notes. Yep. Our first major event that happens to us, and who remembers what that is? Do you remember the Stasik family? He's a little boy who is 10 years old, and he joins the Hitlerjugend the week after his 10th birthday, and he is so wrapped up in this. And what happens?
His parents
say, no way. And what does he do? He commits suicide. Yeah, what a grisly, grisly thing. By hanging in his closet, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hanging in that closet where his father kept all the chess things and everything. He knew he'd been there, you know, and, because his father was the town chess master.
Right. And what is the significance of the Stasik family is regarded in Burgard, but they are different in a way because they are Protestant. And he's the only one, remember, all the rest of these folks that we've been talking about are all part of the Catholic Church. And he is also the principal of the school. And what happens to him?
Gets demoted.
Mm-hmm. And essentially, eventually, he becomes absolutely ruined, doesn't he? A real shadow of himself. On page 207, we are starting to see more and more of the problems that are starting to happen with the Jews becoming more and more troubled with the life that is going on. And I'm determined to learn all your names because it's the last thing I do, and it seems to be the last thing I'm doing this week. And would you read, starting at only a few on page 207, right after the break?
Only a few of the people in Burgdorf had read Mein Kampf, and many thought that all the talk about Rosenreinheit, purity of the race, was ludicrous and impossible to enforce. Yet the long training and obedience to elders, government, and church made it difficult, even for those who considered the views of the Nazis dishonorable, to give voice to their misgivings. And so they kept hushed, yielding to each new indignity, while they waited for the Nazis and their ideas to go away. But with every compliance, they relinquished more of themselves, weakening the texture of the community while the power of the Nazis swelled.
Okay, thank you. So here again, we have the same kind of thing. And at the bottom of page 211, Frau Abramowitz just really doesn't. I have a friend like Frau Abramowitz. Do any of the rest of you have a friend like her? It's going to be better tomorrow. She just does not like to look at things that are negative. She doesn't like to look at things that are sad. And so we always kind of have to watch what we say around her because she just doesn't like it.
Pollyanna.
Yeah, she just doesn't deal well with crisis, frankly. At the bottom of page 211, let's have that for Erla. Why don't you read that little sentence there?
Where you just did it.
The very last sentence.
Ilse. Uh-huh. Ilse thinks all this won't last long. Herr Abramowitz said that all we have to do is keep from being noticed, be polite, and nice.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to find that that's not going to work very long. The next thing that happens in the community, and here again, we have our tight little group of people that we've been reading about all along, and we have the incident outside the grocery where the little Jewish girl is attacked by the six little boys. And what happens? Good old Frau Weiler.
Yeah, I like her.
She's quite a lady, isn't she? Now, let's see, I can't remember. Has her son wanted her to give up the house yet?
This is a different family.
A different family.
Weiler is the grocery store.
Okay, that's right. Weiler is the grocery store.
Whose husband, she thinks, went, you know.
Yeah, oh, that's right. That's the husband that got a little tipsy and fell off the dike, isn't he? Ended up in the drink.
Maybe he just took it.
Because of drink. So Frau Weiler is in jail. And so I think George comes back. Yes, George comes back from the city where he's been working for what was probably one of the first supermarkets, because the food is all packaged. Do you remember reading about that? And you think, you know, we're so used to food being packaged. Does anybody remember back to a grocery store where you had everything?
Sure.
We do. I remember fixing it in the grocery store. So here she is running this store, and now she's in jail, which must have been interesting for the jailer. But George is back taking care of the situation. But before she goes, let's see, in the weeks to come, is she back home? I can't remember, I've marked this, but I've been reading.
She's only there a short time.
Yeah, okay, so she's back after her arrest. And she, and they liked it when George was there. Remember why?
Extra candy.
Extra candy. He would bet with them different things about whether the weather was going to be the next day. He was just a sociable fellow. And they would all bring him goodies. Sounded like kind of a neat deal. Okay, she's back. And on page 213, again, we have this same repetitive thing that we've been hearing. With Leo finally had to take her side. Can you find that, Ruth? Would you like to read there?
Yeah, where do you start on 213?
At Leo finally had to take her side.
Leo finally had to take her side. You're taking unnecessary risk, Hedwig. We can't just be silent. No, but we don't have to put ourselves in danger. You share my views. I know you do. Yes, and I'll talk about them with people I can trust, like you. Hmm. My customers won't report me. Don't be so certain. Last week, Herr Westcott turned in one of his colleagues at the bank. His wife's in your store often enough, but she's not like him. Who knows what she tells him? Besides, you won't have any customers left if you keep talking like that. People are afraid, Hedwig. With good reason, too. Listening to you is dangerous. Emil Hepsik has two friends in the police who are always getting denunciations at the station. They have to follow up on all of them, even those they know are mean-spirited or vindictive. She gave him an impatient laugh. So what do we do, Leo? Just sit here, afraid of what anyone might say about us? Wait for it to get worse? It will get worse, much worse. Maybe all we can do is what you did with the function. Keep vigil right here. And if you're in jail, you won't do any good to anyone.
Thank you. So we keep getting the same thing, kind of over and over and over again.
This is different than Frau Abramowitz, though. Mm-hmm. Who wants to just keep everything quiet, mm-hmm. People resign, we won't object to anything. She's out there. Ready to go with a broom, I guess,
that's her weapon.
The weapon of choice, yes.
I love that earlier, that streetcar ride that, remember when Trudy had finally convinced Ingrid that she could quit saying her rosary 29 times,
right,
or whatever she was doing, okay, and go to the show with her in Dusseldorf, and there were all these pamphlets or flyers that depicted Hitler with old soldiers, you know, brown shirts marching out of his mouth or whatever it was.
And,
the streetcar conductor saw her looking at one, and he said, "Did you bring these in here?" And he was attacking her, and she said, "No, but if I'm picked up by the authorities, I'll have to tell them I found them on your street card."
That was very smart.
Clever.
Yeah. Right. And do you suppose there was a lot of that anti-rhetoric? You know, our cartoonists are oftentimes our most critical social revealers. And that essentially is what was happening there, wasn't it? I've been wondering what Horsey and Trudeau, what their cartoons have been this week. And it'll be interesting to see when we all get home. We're going to have an advantage of having had a week of kind of removal when we go home. It's going to be interesting to see what onslaught we have to deal with in terms of catching up and talking with people. It'll be interesting for all of you.
Will you get let down?
Let down?
No.
No, it'll be a let down. It's always a let down to go from Holden. But, okay, now in the schools, who remembers what was happening in the schools at this time?
Regimentation.
Mm-hmm. The actual look of the schools was changing too. Instead of having just the flag, they now had the Nazi flag. Instead of prayers, what were they saying? And Ingrid, who was her friend who was off teaching and would sort of sneak, remember she wanted, was one who wanted to be the missionary, and she would sneak in the prayer as she could do it. And someone came to observe her class, and the child in innocence said, "But we didn't have our prayer." And she said, "We'll do that later." So things in the schools were changing, which of course was one of the main roles of Nazism, was to get the children involved as soon as possible. There was a lot of power a lot more brown shirts. The children were dressed in the brown shirts. Yeah.
And they also apparently shipped some of the children out to other towns, mm-hmm. Supposedly to protect them, but also that kept them from their parents.
There was a lot of indoctrination that went on.
And those, what were the three anagram, you know, initials for those special schools where they hauled them? They said it was to protect them from possibly being, you know, hit by bombs or whatever, but they actually say they wanted them to themselves where they could indoctrinate.
Right. Well, there are some things that aren't talked about in the book too. There was the other movement which came about this time and a little bit later, where a lot of blonde, blue-eyed women were picked to be wives for the SS troops. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. And to be able to essentially breed the next generation of select Aryan children. And that's not discussed in this book, but certainly has been discussed in a lot of others.
Trudy did say in that one point that was the only time she felt guilty about being blonde and blue-eyed instead of black-haired like Paul Simon.
Well, Hitler had dark hair.
Well, you know, that's the thing that was always so important to me.
Isn't
it? He promoted this Aryan look, and he wasn't Aryan. And the Aryan never was a true race. They came down from Northern Europe.
Didn't he have a Jewish grandmother or something?
Well, we certainly wouldn't discuss that.
I've heard. Trudy told me.
Trudy? We saw in reading in this part, before we get on into the chapter, they talk about the power of words. And do you remember how they describe how the word family starts to change? Mm-hmm. Do you remember that at all?
Now you're suddenly rewarded and you get badges for having, you know,
right.
People, especially if you have a son in the military, but
see, if you had
money,
the
more kids you had, more money.
But you get a certain color badge. It was sort of like you saw later in Russia. You get a certain badge if you've had four children and another if you have six, and an even better one if you have eight.
You also got loans.
They got money in it.
They got money for every kid.
It was a gift. Right.
But I don't know how they were gonna work this, because he took all the men away.
Well, at that point, they all hadn't started, not all of them had gone. This was still 1934, and not quite all of them had gone yet, so a lot of them were still at home.
You want them to be busy at home.
Yes, right. Let's turn these children out as quickly as we can.
It also changed in the family, in that children were urged to even report on their parents if they felt that they weren't loyal to the, right.
We've seen that in other cultural revolutions. This happened in China, too.
Russia?
Mm-hmm.
That's a powerful tool.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it stops everything up.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're afraid to punish a child for something you do wrong, because the next day
they're going to tell the teacher. And you're going to have Children's Protective Services on there.
We have that here, too, because I would ever discipline my children, they say, we'll just call the people and tell them you're abusing. And they probably got trained at school.
Yeah.
You were abused.
But that's always a fine line, too, to be sure that you're sensitive to the children who are, and yet not worry about some of the stories that they are going to tell. I think Trudy would have done a great job at that.
Yes.
On 2:15, it discusses this family and Trudy doubts that she and her father were considered a family.
And where is that? I had that written down too, but I didn't mark it.
2:15, it's the third paragraph.
Okay, yes. And unmarried women were a real problem. And women who couldn't conceive children, that was cause for divorce.
Mm-hmm.
In the new definition of family. The word family had worked its way into most political speeches. It had become a sacred word, a powerful word. And of course you were not a family if you were unmarried, because the individual was the least important unit of the nation. Now that's sure contrary to our nation, isn't it? Where the individual is the important thing. Okay. Then we had some more on marriage. On page 217, the first main paragraph there, which was such an old, and still exists in some parts of the world, the first main paragraph that made her smile. She's got her name tag turned around. Geneva. Okay. All right, you guys, you got to get your name tags out. Geneva, would you read that? Read that paragraph. It made her smile. Trudy singing in the choir.
It made her smile and made her sing louder. For most women, Trudy knew it was not a preference to stay unmarried. Some did not find a suitor, while others did dare to marry a man from another religion or a lower class. To marry into a class above yours was desirable, but seldom possible. In some families, the oldest daughter had to be married before the next one could encourage a suitor, resulting, as with the Burger-like family, in 9 unmarried daughters, whose gradual aging removed one after the other from the wedding market, while the parents fretted over finding a husband for their oldest sibling, whose disposition and features were equally appeared
thin. Wasn't Sabine the one who loved to get new hats? I mean, her hats got more and more outrageous. She was the unmarried one forever and ever.
Took a laugh about Trudy advertising men and women. Mm-hmm. And then sitting there watching them look up.
Right. That's right down in the next paragraph. Did you read that, Julian? It's ever since Klaus had kissed her.
Let's see.
On 217.
Oh, yeah. Ever since Klaus had kissed her, Trudy had been trying to figure out what men look for in women. The marriage ads in the newspaper were the best place to start. She'd skim across the women's section. to the briefer list of announcements from men who wanted to meet women for the purpose of possible matrimony. Many were searching for healthy Aryan women who were younger than they, women who possessed warm hearts for their own businesses, women who liked children and cooking, and leisurely walks and opera. None of them had ever advertised for a Twer woman who knew people's secrets. So I won't go on.
No, do go on, because I think the rest of it is kind of fun.
They usually describe themselves as cultured and successful in the paper, of course. Sometimes both gave their height to the last centimeter, but left out any reference to their hair color, making Trudy deduce that quite likely they were going bald. Her husband was the only man she knew who looked good without hair, probably because he'd been like that since he was a young man.
Okay, thank you. I think this is one of the fun parts of this 120 pages that we've been reading is this. And of course, then she does go ahead and puts in an ad.
Puts in an ad.
Of her own.
She answered two of them, too.
And yeah. And so we'll be hearing, you know, quite a bit more about that as we go along. But, you know, this was kind of funny as I was reading this. I had never thought that this happened prior to the, you know, last few years. And remember when that all started? You know, there was nothing like that in the newspapers until when? 60s? 70s? And now you look at some of the papers and it's all, and you have to figure out this men looking for women, women looking for men, women looking for women, men looking for men. And I saw that. What is all of this? I had to, and then you read these ads and you really have to know the code. It's really a fascinating.
Our paper even has senior women looking for senior men.
Oh, goodness.
Senior men looking for
I suppose
senior
they have outdoor
no,
men looking for
senior men. The thing is that they do it on a computer.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, you can go online and do that as well?
Just, our son-in-law's sister divorced her husband. She got up with a man from Australia.
I know three people who have done that. It's just absolutely amazed me. One left a husband, then she had three children.
But then, you know, and you see that on television, Touched by an Angel had a boy.
Oh, really? Got mail. Well, yeah, got mail. I heard mail. But that one was such a good story.
It was good.
It was a bookstore. I had to do that. But it's, you know, you think that everything is new. Well, you know, just wait, it'll come around again. So this, that was fun for me to read, to find out that this had happened before. So this was
now
not
that a... Now had put a fake picture on and everything.
Oh, really?
Person, you know.
Well, there's a couple ads.
And he right away took her to his apartment.
Oh.
And then, of course, the angel got in there in time to get her away.
Get her away. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has also been used for very, very bad purposes as well.
Yeah.
And with young people. Yeah. And that's sort of scary.
What could Tootie have done with a computer?
Oh, goodness.
What can you do? You can modify your pictures. You can make it taller.
Yes.
She didn't want to know what she looked like, though.
Yeah.
They were really fun computers that had pictures.
Well, then we had a number of life-changing events that I just noted down because they had been so, well, they just, there are certain things that I think everybody can look back in their life and say, you know, there was things were different after that. And the three that I wrote down were Frau Weiland, and when she was defending Finchen, and her life changed. Boy, she was, from there on, she was anti-Nazi. But she talked a lot, so she wasn't really a trustworthy person that they could use from time to time. And Trudy, after the barn, that was a changing event for her. And Klaus's kiss was another changing time for her. And Herr Stasek, after his son's death, and he was demoted, and then the big question about whether or not he should be allowed to stay in the chess club. And on page 221, partway down, let's see, it's the one, two, three, on the fourth paragraph, counting the beginning, Roger, would you like to read that? She saw people.
Okay, talking about Trudy. Trudy saw people arrested for their political beliefs, and she watched how Herr Stasek, who used to be one of the most respected people in Bergdorf, was made an outsider. The day after his son's funeral, he'd been demoted from his position of principal at the Protestant school to that of a teacher. People shunned and harassed him as though he had caused his son's death. His salary was cut to less than half, and he could no longer afford payments on his new car. When he tried to sell it, he received such ridiculous offers that Leo Montag, who didn't really want a car, decided to buy it from him at a proper price. The majority of the men in the chess club voted to move their meeting from his house to the narrow room in back of Potter's Bar. Nearly half of them wanted Gunther Stasek to resign from the club altogether. But when Leo Montag and five other members threatened to resign along with Herr Stasek, they agreed to let him stay, though only, certainly not as president.
Thank you. So here we have another victim, or casualty, however you want to call it. With each of these events, there's something that, in my mind, is one of the worst things that can happen to people, and that's loss of trust. And once that loss of trust exists, I think it just takes away a part of people's humanity. So how to overcome that, or live with it, is always a big factor. Okay, we're up to the year 34 now, between 34 and 38. And on page 228, we have a description of what's happening with the children and their movement that was so influential for them. Third paragraph down, Lorraine, would you like to read that? And how could the children?
And how could the children not love the roaring bonfires and the magnificent folk songs, dark and melancholy and strangely victorious, as their voices united and soared toward the night sky, beyond the blades of red-yellow flames, intoxicating them with the promise of equality. Those children of shopkeepers and teachers, of farmers and lawyers and tailors, all around them they felt a dwindling of the rigid class differences.
That's one good thing that national socialism did. Isn't that terrible? It did something good, erased the class differences.
That probably is a good point, because it was a very hierarchical country prior to that, wasn't it?
It really was socialism. Mm-hmm.
What really happens, though, I think in those cases, it just becomes the different people who are in charge and are the higher class.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you don't really ever get rid of them. Think about Russia.
Like Russia. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What that was just a turnaround.
Yeah.
The lower classes took power. When you look and see what Himmler was before the war,
mm-hmm.
and Hitler himself, Hitler hated the aristocracy. Of course, those Prussian generals, he slowly but surely got rid of a lot of them, even before the start of the war. He hated them. And so you had these people that were in the lower middle class who are now ruling the nation. So it was just a complete flip-flop.
I have kind of enjoyed looking at, it's kind of fun being our age in many ways, because we can look back at things and know that, you know, maybe we probably aren't going to change the world tomorrow, but we can look back and reflect a bit. And it's interesting to me to look at who has the power. I've always been curious about power. And when I was a child, you know, it was the big money people, the Rockefellers and the folks in the East who had the power. And they had the money. And then in the last few years, the sports figures, they're the guys with the big money. But now it's the nerds. And that just makes me feel so good. Finally, brains are the thing that are making the money. And I don't know if any of you know any Microsoft people, but we have quite a few Microsoft people around us. They have made a ton of money. They are great people. And they're retiring at 49 and putting their money back into the community. It's a very interesting situation. So it's just who's got the power. It's kind of like who's on first. So power keeps moving around.
Of course, Bill Gates has preached that,
Yeah, the giving back.
Yeah.
His father preaches it even more. His dad is a great guy. Okay, we're up to 1935. The year I was born. I didn't know this much was going on. But in November of that year, or I'm sorry, September of that year, all the Jews lost their citizenship. And I wonder how many of us in the United States were aware of that.
No. I was 14 and I had no inkling of what was going on.
A lot of news did not come out of Germany at that point, did it? About this kind of thing.
Yeah, but in my high school, I had a couple of German Jewish students that came and started going to school with us. And I had, there was a Japanese student that, I was wondering when he was talking about the displacement from here, how that student got sent to Cincinnati, Ohio, to go to high school with us. But his parents were probably in an internment camp or something.
Probably. Well, they sent them away from the coast.
Yeah. We didn't have big discussions in the high school about it, but we were aware that they were there because of the war situations where they had come from.
Was he from the coast?
He's from, well, I know that he just died a couple of years ago in Portland, Oregon. And he came back for our 45th reunion because he wanted to thank the one man in our high school that had befriended him and been so kind to him. And that man had just died the week before.
Because the Japanese from the west of the mountains were not interred, nor would they live in their east of the mountains. And so, or from the interior of the east coast, they were not.
But a lot from the ones from the west were sent.
Oh yes, all of the ones west of the mountains.
Were there that many?
Overnight.
Well, probably not.
Yeah. Well, there were some in eastern Washington.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to let you know. Were they left in eastern Washington? When the ones in eastern Washington, were they interned or were they left alone?
I think they were interned. And there weren't that many. You know, most of them were on the coast because they were involved in the fishing industry mostly. And
produce garden.
Produce, right. Mm-hmm. Right. And the story of the Bainbridge Island. What I don't have you all read Snow Falling on Cedars?
Yep.
It's a beautiful book. And it's this true story. Loosely put, but a true story.
They make a movie.
Historical fiction.
Yeah, it is. He really, and the thing that always amazed me about that book was that he was such a young man that how he could have captured that so well, because he didn't live alive at that time. But his father was, and his father was a pretty outstanding person. So he's a judge. We also had another event in 35 in Bergdorf. Eva Rosen married Alexander Strom. She's a Jew. He's a Protestant, or Catholic rather, sorry. And he's the one, remember, that had the new apartment house and established her there. And then we had a very sad time, which we'll get to in just a minute, but this problem that kept going, the adaptation was one of the big things that happened. And another one is described on page 239.
The people of Bergdorf went to parades and speeches, some like the taxidermists because they genuinely believe in their leaders, others like Herr Ball because not to go would call attention to yourself. Most practiced the silence they were familiar with, a silence nurtured by fear and complicity that would grow beyond anything they could imagine, mushrooming into the decades after the war, which some began to fear was about to happen.
Okay, thank you. Well, now go on to the next paragraph, actually, that's important.
To justify this silence, they tried to find the good in their government or fled into the mazes of their own lives, turning away from the community. They knew how not to ask questions. They had been prepared for it by government and church. Over the years, they had forgotten that early urge to question. For some, their one act of resistance was that, whenever they could avoid it, they didn't raise their arm in the aisle that would reading. But others, like Herr Rimmers and Herr Westcott, used that greeting whenever they could, often as a challenge to test those they encountered.
So we had adaptation and silence. Two very powerful denial factors.
Something else that happened just previous to that that was tragedy to Trudy, and she found all kinds of evil things to think, was Klaus the dentist started dating this rich lawyer's daughter from out of town.
Right.
Who was tall.
Yeah. As well. We also had one other thing that happens during this time, which, being a dog lover, he was an old dog, but you know, how many of you have had an old dog? I've got one right now. I have to have a house sitter come when I go away because the dog can't, I don't want the dog to go to the kennel. The dog's going to die. I want it to be right there. So, and you know, you never know when you get home, the dog is still going to be there. I know Mark can take care of it. So that's pretty bad when you have to hire a house sitter for the dog. Page 247. At the very bottom, we get back into, Trudy finds out about the pharmacist's secret. She really goes to quite a few lengths, remember?
Yeah.
I mean, she goes and looks it up in the, where does she go to look it up? Some official place.
Your birth
certificate.
Right.
That is Trudy Montague searched through dusty records in the Rathaus, where she found the dates of his parents' wedding and of his christening, yet no account of his birth. Now, I mean, this is a woman who is really going to get information. I mean, she's just got this. You know, you're right, Barbara. What would she done with this? She would have filed everybody in her computer.
The reason she didn't like that woman,
Did you hear Mariel say it again, Mariel?
The reason she didn't like the woman coming from out of town, she didn't have any secrets on her. How could she like her?
In the end, she even felt sorry for her when she got dumped, you know, for the young girl.
Well, she is something else, that is for sure. At the very last bottom part of the page on 247, let's see, Marianne, why don't you read that, starting there and on through the rest of the next
even
page.
That paragraph?
And yet. Very loud.
And yet, whatever people gave Trudy was not enough, could never be enough. If she couldn't have their acceptance, at least she'd have their stories. That's what the people of Bergdorf owed her, because she'd come into their middle because of her difference. Because they could not accept her, they owed her something. And she'd extract that payment ruthlessly, banking on their pity, their guilt, their relief. But to her own secrets, she held on, accumulating power by keeping separate what was hers and what belonged to others. One day it struck her that it was almost like hoarding money for people who worshipped wealth. How much she had that was hers, what she took away from others, what she gave to others, what she hoarded. There was even interest because what she already owned grew as she added that which came from others, and it gave her a sense of wealth, of pride. Sometimes the mass of secrets felt totally useless, a sharp-edged block that encumbered her. Those were the times when she would have liked to give up all the secrets if only she could have had what she craved most deeply, the connection to others.
Mm-hmm. So it really filled a void for her. I don't know that I've ever known anyone quite like that. In 38, we have the flood. And it sounded like a terrible flood. It sounded like the Mississippi coming right down through so many parts of the Midwest. They had this problem over and over and over again. But in the process of that flood, we have our old friend coming back and bringing things and leaving them again.
The benefactor.
He just keeps cropping up every now and then. But and then we have the first disappearance of one of the Jews from Bergdorf, Frau Simon. Remember Trudy? The milliner. Mm-hmm. Trudy is getting a new hat. And that was, remember when we used to go and buy hats? It was so much fun to sit there and try all those hats. You just don't do that. I mean, that's not a part of our life anymore. But the milliner was, you know, a very important part of life. And, of course, the latest styles and the right color and to match your outfit. And if you had a new outfit, then you went and got your new hat. And everybody on Easter showed up with a new hat. Right? That was part of our lives. So Trudy has been to see the hat maker, and she had tried on the one hat, and Frau Simon was a really good saleswoman. She said, well, now I'll just put this other one aside for you for a few days, and you think about it, because it really looks so good on you. And then what happens? Up comes the black card. They took her for questioning. Right. And on page 257, we have the Abramowitz is again, but essentially this is what started to happen. Let's see, who hasn't read yet that would like to read? Volunteers. Go ahead, Barbara. Thank
you. Where do you want me to start?
Here, right here. Here, Abramowitz. That whole next two, those two paragraphs.
Here, Abramowitz raised his chin and stared at the piano with the silver-framed photos of his children, dating from infancy to 3 years earlier when his son Albert had left for Argentina after many attempts to persuade his parents and sister to join him. We weren't ready then, Herr Abramowitz thought. We waited too long, and Ruth still wasn't ready to go without her husband. But he and Ilse had finally agreed to let Albert help. How he hated the waiting, the uncertainty. Nearly half of the Jewish community in Germany, which had numbered 500,000 in 1933, had already left the country. But for those who hadn't, it was becoming harder and harder to find a place that would take them. Even Palestine was no longer an option. Because of Arab objections, the British had restricted immigration into Palestine, hindering what had once looked like a workable agreement between the Palestinian Zionist organization and the Nazis to keep Jewish wealth in a fund in Germany, which was to be used for buying German exports to Palestine, while the Zionists were to take care of Jewish immigrants, and other nations, including the United States, severely restricted Jewish immigration. Nobody wants impoverished Jews, Herr Abramowitz thought bitterly. There'd be no problem for us if we could take our money out of Germany. The real irony is that we're still here, not because the Nazis prevent us from leaving, but because we have no place to go.
Mm-hmm. And we find later that, I think this is in tomorrow's part, they try four times. They have the approval to go, and then four times at the last minute. It disappears. And again, how would you know when enough is enough? 250,000 people did leave. That's a lot of people to leave. And they probably left a lot. There's a wonderful film called The Gardens of the Finzi Continis. I don't know if any of you have ever seen it. It's an Italian film, and it's about a Jewish family in Italy who are very, very wealthy and had one of the few libraries in this town. And they did not leave. in time. And their life, which was somewhat like the Abramowitzes, they were wealthy, they had everything within their beautiful, beautiful house, but they didn't want to leave it. And so they lost their lives. And this, of course, is what happened to the other 250,000. Does anybody remember what the final number was of Jews? Do you know, John?
Well, they usually say 6 million in all of Europe.
Yeah.
Died. But I don't think anybody ever has an exact number of how many it was that died. They know there aren't very many left in Germany at the end of the war.
Yeah, and then most of them were hidden somehow or another under false passports.
And even some of those that escaped went to places like Holland or France, and then they were scooped up later. Mm-hmm. So not all of those 250,000 were safe at the end of the war.
This was the first time I had read these figures, which is why I wanted to sort of bring it out, that this was the existence at that time. It's on page 257. In November of 38, we have the beginning of Jewish businesses being destroyed. And I don't know that I wrote down the date for, and I will say it right, the Glasnacht, when the night of glass breaking and all the book burning that occurred. But that was about this same time. And I think in some ways that information did get out to the West. I don't know that we did anything very constructive with it, except to be shocked. But the night of the bonfires and all the glass breaking, that information I can remember in March of time. Anybody remember that? The movie reels that, you know, you went to the movies and you had the March of Time and you had the cartoon and you had something else and then you had the movie.
Cafe News.
Cafe News, right.
Yeah, Cafe News.
The previews, right. Oh, it was fun. I mean, we all had stuff. Now you get previews of the movie. So. But in November of 38 was when the Jewish businesses were all broken into and things were taken and they were destroyed. On page 269 was about the Baroness, I'm sorry. But we also have the Baroness being a reason for people to divorce. That was wrong point. But we also have at the same time, Herr Abramowitz was taken from his home and beaten. 265.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's when they found him.
Tortured.
He had been taken by other than that.
Yeah, it was about this.
It was about 263.
Three.
Mm-hmm. Late Friday night.
Yes, okay. Less than 12 hours before Helmut's wedding to the blonde midwife, he and two other SA men dragged Herr Abramowitz from his bedroom, ruined his camels, which was all of the thing that he was so fond of, dragged across the fragments, screaming as they cut his feet and ankles, and then he was beaten, and he was returned to his home. But that was the first time we find one of the people in the circle of which we're reading about being actually harmed by someone else. In 1939, in September, the Nazis invaded Poland. Also in 1939, in November, there was an attack on Hitler's life. If you read the history of Bonhoeffer, that attack on Hitler's life is described quite in quite detail. And there were a number of people who knew that that was going to happen. Unfortunately, it wasn't successful. And I don't know what would have happened had it been. How history would have gone, but that was in November of 39. So now, here comes Helmut in the house. 273. Helmut. Ugh. Helmut. Remember, she had the premonition. Helmut was going to be a problem for his mother. Way back when he was a baby. Okay.
Helmut means...
I'm sorry.
Helmut means bright mood.
Bright mood?
Mm-hmm. So he wasn't very bright.
That was an oxymoron.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know that I would go with that one, but... let's see, Pat, would you like to read a little bit on page 273 at the top there? This is Helmut's he's talking to his mother.
Just after all, stop there. After all, as a widow, you don't need much space, he had told her the week after his wedding. Well, Hilda and I will have a lot of children. He was determined to convert the government's marriage loan to a gift, and eager for Hilda to learn the... Okay. And Rensen der Deutschen Mutter. Already he pictured the bronze cross of honor on his dress, to be replaced, of course, by the silver cross and the gold cross as his family grew. But his mother didn't understand. You are welcome to live upstairs, she said. He pointed to the gleaming parquet floor. You have to admit that the entire house has been cared for much better ever since I married Hilda. I don't ask your wife to clean for me. She likes to clean. Why are you so stubborn about the house? I am too old to live like a guest.
Thank you. I think that... I do like this lady. She sort of sticks up for her own, and even though she's got this nasty son, she manages to kind of keep on going, despite it. But Hilda, I think, is not quite as bad a person as her husband. She really seems to be caring about her mother-in-law and watches out for her. And when Helmut goes off to the war, she still stays upstairs. She doesn't move into her mother-in-law's space till after she is taken away. So I think Hildy might not, we don't need to put her in the bad person side of our ledger.
And she hides Hitler's picture.
Yes.
But she was a lot more interested in other things than she was on that.
She even stayed upstairs after.
That's right.
Oh, after the mother disappeared.
After the mother disappeared. Uh-huh.
You know, one really cute character that was in today and yesterday, too, that we haven't talked about was Adele Pated sister Adelaide.
Oh, I forgot that.
Who got locked up on the third story or something because she she stole the communion elements. Was having church by herself.
She certainly wasn't she had a good comic, one. But she was she was an interesting character that was sort of inserted, wasn't she? Mm-hmm. And she, when Trudy was out visiting with her at the gate, and they were having this big discussion, and then comes the nun to catch. We live, I don't know how many of you know, but we live on an island with a monastery of nuns. And it's called a priory, because it's one step up from being a monastery. And from time, there aren't a lot of young nuns, as you all know. And so they've had a number of these who are really older ladies who have really lost their marbles. And so they just kind of wander around. And so then the nuns come and collect them and bring them back. And it's a locked monastery. They aren't. There's only two or three of them who are out in the public. And it's very much like Sister Adelaide. But we all know it. And so, you know, you just kind of send it. In your monastery?
I thought it was so cute because the worst thing she could do would be to steal the communion elements, and she was a woman and a nun,
right.
And to try to be the priest and have church by herself.
That's why she got in trouble, because she tried to serve communion.
Right.
Pretty thinks of her as kind of angelic, doesn't she?
I think so. There's a little bit of her in here. Okay. We have the introduction of a new character in 1939, Matthias. Who was 10 years old, Matthias Berger, comes into the picture and gives Trudy someone else to kind of talk to. And he plays the piano, and he's very good at the piano. So he's kind of a new person. And we're going to hear more about him as time goes on. This also in 1939 was the time when the Jews had to wear the yellow star. That was the introduction of the yellow star. They had to wear, I believe it was on the left arm. It was a band that they had to wear at all times. And they had to live in what was called Jewish houses. So many of them were transported from their houses to what were called Jewish houses, which meant that a lot of them had to give up fairly comfortable homes for more cramped space. And more people disappeared without any trace. And then we had Klaus Malter, the dentist, who is supposed to be married. And what happens there?
To the rich sister teacher from out of town, but he found a younger girl.
Yeah, he sort of skipped the bill, didn't he? Who would like to tell about that? What happened? Remember, he was, I can't remember what her name was. What was
it? Jutta.
Jutta. Now, Jutta's the one that he ended up marrying, isn't it?
Husband.
Yes, she is.
But I don't even remember the name of the other. Whatever happened to her. Did we ever hear whatever happened to her? She just kind of abandoned her.
She just. Yeah. Put her tail between her legs and had to go home to her dad.
Yeah, and do you remember Jutta earlier in the book?
Mm-hmm. Wild and crazy.
And she was the little kind of disheveled little girl who came in and sat down in the mass next to this rather proper lady, and the proper lady really didn't want Jutta to sit next to her. Do you remember that?
And she liked to swim in the gravel pits.
Yes. She's kind of a wild girl. But by golly, Klaus ends up marrying her.
Jutta, isn't that her name, Jutta?
Jutta. German, how would I? Scandinavian, it would be Jutta. But I don't know German.
It must be Jutta.
This is where they talk about the dentist working.
Okay, on page 292 at the bottom. You have it right there. Your turn. 292, yes. Yeah, you cover your name so I can't.
You have to wear
which paragraph do you want?
Just after the break there, the rumors.
The rumors about Klaus and Jutta kept Trudy busy for weeks as she distributed each unfolding of their romance throughout Bergdorf. As long as she kept telling and retelling that story, she didn't have to let in her jealousy of Jutta that swallowed her when she was alone and silent, an ugly jealousy that found its only moments of reprieve when she could remind herself of her satisfaction that Bridget had been ousted. Yet Trudy had become so accustomed to seeing Klaus with the lawyer's daughter all those years that her initial resentment had been supplanted by the belief that the two suited one another.
There's a good line in the next paragraph.
Okay, go ahead.
That war kept spreading like ink on a linen cloth.
But even the gossip about the dentist's reckless love made it impossible to forget that war kept spreading like ink on a linen cloth. And she gathered and distributed facts about the war along with gossip about Klaus. She read in the newspaper that the June attack on Russia had resulted in 300,000 Russian prisoners. It worried and infuriated her that the situation had worsened for the Jews. They were no longer encouraged to emigrate, but instead were ordered to vacate their homes on short notice. They were restricted to living in houses that had been declared Jewish houses, supposedly to monitor and hinder any interaction between Aryans and Jews. Closer and closer they had to live together, separated from the rest of the town by an invisible wall.
This is now a ghetto.
Right. Except they didn't seem to be all in one place. They were probably scattered around. Have any of you ever read any of the ghetto stories?
What they have, what was it called? When they had, they attacked the ghetto and just cleaned them out.
Warsaw.
In Warsaw.
There's a
name, name for that.
Oh, the pogroms.
Pogrom.
Pogrom. Okay, it says the number of Jews in Bergdorf had shrunk drastically. Two families had disappeared from the Catholic congregation. Even the priest hadn't known they were Jewish until the Gestapo had investigated their background. So it was a pretty terrible situation. But Trudy's in 1941-42 is kind of keeping busy with her own kind of thing here. She puts another ad in the paper. And she shows up. But she does it in kind of a funny way. What does she do?
She cut out a picture of a fashion model and pasted it into the letter to represent as Ash herself. And
then when he comes and she recognizes who it is, she gives him a letter that she says was written by this beautiful lady that went by, whereupon they start a conversation and he drives her home. And this is Max Rudnick, who is a teacher, but who has been dismissed from his teaching job, so we know something has happened there. And he's a private tutor. But he's persistent, isn't he? He keeps coming back. So there's a connection between these two.
About what page would that be?
Well, it's starting on page 297, and it goes on up through 320. He just keeps kind of showing up. And he just is, he likes to play chess with her father, and he keeps asking her to go to dinner or to do something, and she keeps saying no. And so my final note here is kind of like, will Trudy ever go out with him? But there's some other things that were happening during that time. Klaus Malter, the dentist, remember his mother was a philosophy teacher at the university? She's arrested, but she was released, but she was not given her post back. And the weak and the deformed and the retarded were all starting to be arrested. Why wasn't Trudy?
Yeah. Because she had blonde hair and blue eyes.
She had too much information.
That SS neighbor of the baker, Hansen, convinced them to send that boy to the institution because he was better at, you know, living with others like himself, the one that didn't have any arms. And
the parents were kind of exhausted from caring for him.
And then sometime later they get the word that he had suffered some fatal disease.
Right. He got an illness and they sent back the urn. Well, we finish our section today with Trudy now being 26 years old. So she's grown to womanhood. She does have a suitor who is pursuing her quite actively. And I think, you remember that first paragraph at the beginning of the book? We know something's going to happen sometime in this book, so maybe in the next 200 pages we'll find out what's going to happen. I've wondered many times why Trudy wasn't swept up. Of course, we lose our narrator if that happened. But I think maybe that'll be answered a little bit somehow. Bergdorf was a small town, and I think after a while the Nazis could only go after so many people. And I think maybe that some of that spared her.
After she was picked up that time and detained in the prison, that same SS officer who had been one of the two that picked up Frau Simon, the Hadley owner, and she said at that time in the narration that he didn't seem to be quite as zealous a Nazi. He seemed kind of not to be interested in even in what he was doing. And then he recognized her again. She was called into his office and it was because he took pity on her that she was released that time, or that might have been undoing.
Well, remember when Frau Simon and the two SS officers were there, and she looked into his eyes, remember that? And she saw, you know, that he really wasn't dedicated to what he was doing, and he immediately, you know, changed. And so, because he recognized that she recognized this, I mean, this, she had must have had some perceptive powers that people recognized.
She thought her a little. If you told one SS officer, I knew your mother.
That's, I don't remember that with that incident, because those two men were strangers, I think. Okay. Yeah.
Jewish lady, wasn't it? Trying to take her
husband off. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
I knew your mother.
You right.
Know, yeah, she's a wonderful woman.
Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
Before we leave today, I had made a little note on 219.
Okay.
I discussed the stones.
Good. Okay.
Could you comment on that for me, please?
Okay, now where are we?
Well, at 219, she took that panic. She felt that not being able to be with Klaus, and added four stones. One stone for living him, one for hating him, one for Lauren, one for Graves. The rocks were cold to her touch, and she said, a fifth one for being ashamed of loving Klaus. But I wondered how this relates to the title of the book.
Well, we had the symbolism of the stones before when she was assaulted in the barn. Mm-hmm. And remember, she went and she picked up the stones from the river and she threw them as hard as she could. Stones are going to come back in tomorrow's reading as well, in a different way. And so stones are used throughout the book as a metaphor for anger at this point. But in the next part, they're going to be for protection.
Mm. So 220, she says, Trudy added stones for her mother, for her brother, stones for George, Fritz and Hans, Paul and Eva, but, and until her head was spinning.
Mm-hmm.
So that's her way of her getting rid of anger, is that?
I think so.
And then the boyfriend, when he sees that little monument that she's made, the one on the bank, makes her, yeah, I don't care where she explains
that. That's tomorrow.
Yeah, oh, sorry.
That's tomorrow, you've got to reach that point. Marianne has great recall. We appreciate that. That keeps us going.
There's one other page, one other thing on page 267.
Okay.
Right at the break, at the bottom, Frau Abramowitz is talking. This is after her husband has been beaten, and they're really not sure what's going to happen to them now. They're pretty much aware that being Jewish is certainly not the best situation in Germany. And she says that a thought came to her that had insisted on settling with her for some time now, a thought that would anger Michael if she ever told him, given a choice, she would rather be the one who was persecuted than the one who did the persecuting. Both had a terrible price to pay, but she would rather endure humiliation and fear than grow numb to what it was to be human.
Mm-hmm. That same thought is brought up with the Abramowitzes in tomorrow's reading as well. Mm-hmm. So you'll see that same thing again.
And that's really something to think about.
Yeah.
We haven't said anything about his double teeth either.
That was his otherness, wasn't it?
So that when he got the beating, he just knocked out the front row.
Yeah.
Still
I couldn't quite figure that one out, but not being a dentist.
There's another line when Leo says to Tony something about his fear for Germany, for the fate of Germany if they should win the war.
Yeah, yeah, I think it was Herr Hesping that says that. Or was it Leo? It was one of the two.
One of them, yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, tomorrow you're going to see Herr Hesping coming into a very strong role. And you're going to see stones again. So keep reading, it's easier from here on. Scarier in some parts, but easier. So tomorrow, let's see if we can get, we're at 220, no, we're at 320 now. 320 to 420 will take us up through 1943. some very critical times in German history. Okay, any more thoughts before we get ready for hiking? Kind of ambassador.
That's right.